okay for you?
Yeah.
Voilà, bonjour. Bienvenue à cette présentation élargie de Greg Brownmore. Je voulais commencer par faire une petite introduction sur Greg, même si je pense que la plupart d'entre vous, vous avez eu l'occasion de lui parler, en tout cas de voir son travail. J'ai rencontré Greg il y a quelques mois. Il est venu à la maison d'ailleurs à Yverdon pour exposer les œuvres que vous voyez au premier étage ici. On a eu beaucoup le temps de discuter de son travail et évidemment son travail est intéressant puisque à la fois Greg a la chance de travailler pour Weta Workshop et donc de travailler sur des films, des jeux vidéo et autres effets spéciaux. Puis en même temps, il développe son propre travail personnel. Et c'est un peu les deux choses qui va prendre le temps de vous présenter aujourd'hui. La première question que je vais lui poser, c'est finalement de savoir ce que ça lui fait, lui qui vient de Nouvelle-Zélande, de pouvoir exposer deux fois dans la même année, une fois en Suisse, une fois en France, de montrer son travail à des gens qui, pour certains le connaissaient, mais pour d'autres peut-être un peu moins, et de voir comment il se rapporte à ça.
And this is a question about you expose in Switzerland and in France.
Yeah.
You know, what is good for you for that, and maybe you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. Hey. So hello everyone. Kia ora. I'm Greg Broadmore. I'm from Weta in New Zealand. And as Mark has pointed out, my exhibition is now here at Utopia House Festival, the world of Dr. Grodbort, and it has previously been at the Maison d'Ailleurs in Switzerland. And this is actually the fifth place it's been. It's actually previously toured through China. It was in Chengdu, and it was in Hong Kong and Shanghai. And it's actually quite a strange rite of passage that it's traveling on. It's a world that is known somewhat in New Zealand and is well known in America, but is actually very little known here. So, but it actually feels like it's sort of come home. When it went to Switzerland, to the Maison, it's very much like there is a beautiful museum there of Jules Verne and a museum that focuses on science fiction. So it feels very much like the perfect place. And then coming here, it feels as if it's coming home. This is the birthplace of Jules Verne. And he is one of the original creators, of course, of science fiction, or one of the people that crystallized it and helped to form it. And this is the sort of science fiction that has inspired me to create this world. So it feels like it's in the right place.
Voilà, maintenant, en fait, Greg avait assez envie de vous montrer son travail, puisque vous savez qu'il a travaillé principalement sur District 9, le film District 9. Et puis peut-être qu'avant d'introduire l'univers de Dr. Grodbort, il pourrait montrer ce qu'il a fait avant. Il a quelques slides ici pour voir aussi comment un univers se crée, comment un imaginaire se cristallise, et puis de quelle manière on arrive en fait à créer quelque chose d'original. Alors il va vous présenter un petit peu le concept artistique de District 9. Et peut-être pour l'image, on peut la lancer.
Yeah. So, can I ask, are people getting a translation in their headphones? You are? Oh, great. Okay. Fantastic. Yes, so, I'll just introduce myself a little bit more. For those of you who were here the other day, it's going to be a lot of repeating. But as I say, I'm from Weta Workshop. And Weta is one of several companies in New Zealand that is created by Peter Jackson and Richard Taylor and Jamie Selkirk and others who have built a film industry in New Zealand, making films instead of traveling to Los Angeles and setting up in Hollywood. Peter decided to make his film empire in Wellington, where he lives. And luckily for me, that means I have a job because previously to Peter starting this enterprise, there's very little to do for an artist in New Zealand, especially an artist like myself that likes to do fantastical and imaginative art. There's only 4 million people in New Zealand. It's a small place, very difficult economy to do anything. If you wanted to make comics like I did in New Zealand, there were very few places to do it. So, and you couldn't make any money out of it, that's for sure. So I was actually unemployed for most of my life, and I sort of gave up the idea that I would ever actually have a real job, and I figured I would just try and dodge the unemployment people and get by as best as I could. But luckily for me, Lord of the Rings came along, and even though I was a fan of Peter Jackson's films, I had no idea how significant it would be to me. I was shocked by how incredible it was. And so at the time I was living in Wellington, and so I was selling the last of my stuff. I had started working a crappy job in a video game store because I just didn't know what else to do. And then The Lord of the Rings came out, and suddenly it's like, this is it. These are people making fantastical films in the town I live in. I have to get a job there. And so luckily enough, for me, Richard Taylor thought, like my moxie, he thought I was, I had something, and he started employing me. And then very shortly after that, I was working on King Kong and then Narnia and then a number of other films. And it sort of all culminated for me. The most satisfying film I worked on was District 9 with Neil Blomkamp. And that was a film that came from the ashes of Halo, the feature film based on the video game. And as much as I was enjoying developing the world of Halo into a movie, District 9 was far more satisfying because it was starting from a blank slate and getting to create something completely new. So I'll show you, run you through some of the artwork, and I'll perhaps talk about some of the specifics of how this happens. And the artwork you're going to see is probably, I don't know, 1% of all the artwork I did, and probably a fraction of a percent of all the artwork created by the various artists who work on the film. So you're just seeing a little glimpse, and a very egotistical glimpse, because it's really just my work. So I might actually set that going. So early on in the film, this is probably about a third of the way in, we're just working on various summoning up scenes of the film, like trying to imagine various key scenes that sort of hit the various story notes and summed up the character. And this was actually to communicate to investors what the sort of film was we were going to make. So, I mean, you can see that it's quite different than what appears in the film in a way, but it's early on in the process. So, you know, the way it was shot ended up, you know, the film evolved a lot. In the early stages, the screenplay was incredibly loose. If you had read the screenplay that Neil first gave to me, it bore no resemblance to the film that was on the screen, really, not in terms of the true story. Neil is a very fluid and organic filmmaker, as is Peter Jackson, where they are willing to change direction and adjust things as they go through. So, for instance, at the very at the end of District 9, the main character lives, or, you know, he is transformed into an alien. But at one point, he was going to die. He was going to be killed in a martyr-like event. And in another variation of the film, he was going to survive, and he was going to be, you know, kill all the bad guys. So, and it went between many, many different outcomes. This was a favorite scene that never made it into the movie. Vikas Vandermeer was supposed to get into arguments and fights with the aliens. He was going to end up living amongst them, and they didn't end up really getting a great deal of time in the film. But he was basically here. He was drunk, and basically almost going to get ripped to shred by these angry aliens because he just lost it. He couldn't handle it anymore. He'd been ostracized by his society, and now he's having to live with the people that he despised, or live with this race that he thought were, you know, insects basically to him. For me, it was a very fascinating movie to work on because I had a long interest in South Africa, and I thought it was a unique place to set a film. It's a very very tense place. It has a historical, a recent history of great tension between the various races and tribes, and it's a very fractured place. It still is, I think. And so I think it's perfect setting for a dramatic film, you know. But because of the way Hollywood investment works, they don't tend to take those kind of risks. It's very seldom that you would get a film with a different setting like that, with unknown actors. Very seldom that you would get that turn up in a feature film. So I was very excited by it because, like I said, it was unlike anything I'd seen before. But at the same time, it had things that I love and I'm familiar with. I mean, here you can see the giant robot from a very early version of the giant robot from the end of the film, the exosuit. And that was, you know, for me and for Neil, he's a huge fan of RoboCop and of the early 80s and 70s science fiction films. So, like, while some of the ingredients were very interesting and very risky, there are other things that are just, you know, science fiction staples that I love. You know, I love giant robots ruining stuff, so how can you go wrong? And I knew I was going to get to design one. And so to see it finally, you know, flying around on the screen, blowing everything to bits, is a very childlike thrill. I'm sure you're all very aware of what concept art is, but if you aren't, concept art is the process whereby an artist or a team of artists get direction from a client, a filmmaker, and have to design everything that needs building, that needs imagining for a film. Anything unique in a film, a spaceship, an alien, a creature, a costume, an environment, it all needs to be concept designed by someone. And, of course, in a film like District 9, there is a lot of concept design to do, many, many weapons and so on.
Maybe D'abord, je vais le dire en français. Peut-être que tu pourrais nous dire en deux mots le nombre d'esquisses, parce que je me rappelle d'avoir entendu ça, c'était assez hallucinant, le nombre d'esquisses qui étaient faites pour le film et puis qui étaient en fait transformées réellement.
Maybe you can just remember in the PFL you said about how many sketches you draw and
yeah.
They just select a few one. Just maybe more about the concept, the way they are.
Yeah. So at the early stage of a film, we work very, very, very fast. You're under an enormous pressure to make many designs that fit the film, that are at the request of the designer, of the director, so that we can start building them. You have an incredibly short amount of time. You need to design them, then build them, then we need to paint them and ship them to the set so that we can get them on stage, get them in front of the camera. And so early on, the process is very organic and very open. You know, Neil might say he wants some weapons for District 9. He wants the technology to be alien. He wants it to be different. Maybe it's complex. Maybe it's this. He has a bunch of different ideas for what it could be. But even he's not entirely sure. He sort of knows generally where it wants to be. And so it's our role as a concept artist to generate as many possibilities as we possibly can. We try and although you're seeing here designs that are very similar to the ones that are in the film, the designs that we created were very, very far-fetched. There were very organic things that you wouldn't even think were a weapon. There were things that were far more mechanical, ostensibly with much more mechanics over top. There were ones like this where there is graphic branding and very strong colors. There is basically anything anyone can imagine, you know. In the early stage, we are doing as many of these as we can a day. They're very quick, very loose, and we probably try and do anything up to between 5 and 12 drawings a day, something like that, just to try and fire out ideas very, very quickly, just like, here's an idea, here's an idea, here's an idea. And as you get into the film, as you start to find your way and you start to discover a look, then it becomes more specific, and maybe we slow down a little bit, get a bit more into the detail. And when a director has chosen an object, for instance, this design was chosen to go in the film, I would do these orthographic views and, three-quarter views and so on, and be a bit more specific so that someone could go away and actually make the model. And then on top of that, I would go down into the workshop and work with the artists actually building these props. And for this design, it probably took me a couple of days to design it and a couple of days to do all the different views. And then it would have taken an artist in the workshop floor maybe, I would say, almost up to 6 weeks to build it. And it was, but in the end, it was so heavy and so complex. And this thing actually had a big backpack attached to it with all these pipes coming out and so on. In the end, it was so heavy and complex that they didn't even use it on the screen at all. I don't even know if it's in one frame of film, for all I know. And that's very common in the filmmaking process. You make it generate a lot of content. Most of that content will never be seen because it's merely ideas. And then even the stuff that is made, I would say the chances are about 20 or 30% that it's actually going to make it to the screen. Here's another. I mean, this was actually a design that was done because we were going to do prosthetics for the aliens. There were going to be people in suits. It was the cheapest possible way to do it. And even though District 9 is $37 million budget, that's very small for a feature film with so much special effects in it. And so we thought so many aliens in the background, we can't put them all in suits. It takes hours to put these people into these very complex suits. So maybe you only put one or two people in these suits, but we could in the prosthetic. But we could put them in these suits where you just basically put on a helmet and you're pulling on a big costume over top of that. Maybe it only takes half an hour to get into the suit. So therefore we could manufacture, I don't know, half a dozen of these suits, and therefore we can populate the background of the screen with these people, and the audience will believe that there are more aliens than there actually are, and then you can use compositing to increase that. In the end, the visual effects people in Canada, Image Engine and Embassy VFX, who are responsible for most of the digital effects, they excelled themselves so much, and they, I don't know what they did, but they had some magic recipe, and they really worked their asses off and were able to do very, very high-quality versions of the CG alien. And so it negated, again, all of this work that we'd done. We actually made this as a suit, and I was very proud of it. I thought, although it was a compromised solution to a problem, I was very happy with it, and then it doesn't even make it into the film at all. And like I say, that's actually very normal. Yeah. And here, there's basically, although the aliens obviously need design, there's also the design of the various weapons of the MNU and their costumes. And I wanted them to feel slightly futuristic, but they wanted to feel like a paramilitary group from today, but with maybe slightly more sophisticated equipment. We also went through a lot of effort. Larry Greer was the guy responsible for doing the branding, and he would do all the logos, the specific... Everything is invented. Everything. There's not one thing in the film that doesn't have the hands of an artist from Weta or from Image Engine on it in Embassy. And as you can see, a very different version of the exosuit. I don't know how many of you are familiar with District 9, but the exosuit went through many, many different versions. In fact, that version that you saw was one that we built completely and sent to South Africa, and the same process happened. They actually shot it. They did all their scenes with it. I'll flick forward to it if I can find it. So this was an early version of it. Then we went through various mechanical iterations. I focused on this very much because I knew that this is the sort of design I love, and I wanted to have a design like this in a film. So I went at it 100%, trying to do as many designs as I could. And you can see they're all very different, you know, trying different takes. This one is obviously very mechanical, and this one has like materials leaking out of it as if perhaps it has a musculature underneath or it has a biological entity to it. Ones that are far more angular and simplified. And this was the one that was actually built and sent to South Africa, and it opened up. So the actor, Sharlto Copley, got inside and did all his scenes, as well as the actor who played Obisanjo. And then I think it wasn't until after the film was shot that Neil decided, during the CG phase, when they were building the CG version of this, the computer graphic version, that... Neil decided, no, it's just not aggressive enough. I want something with more punch. He wanted something that reminded him of ED-209 from RoboCop. And that's where the new version came from, which was substantially bigger. And instead of being an exosuit where you put your legs in the legs and your arms in the arms and so on, it became more of a robot that you drove inside of. You know, you sat in the torso. And, of course, the black one from the film. And, again, lots of branding and detailing on it to make it feel as if it was a mass-manufactured object from this alien culture. And there are many inspirations, you know, for me. Of course, I say RoboCop, and it's definitely that's a film that left an indelible mark on me. I loved it. I loved the mix of satire, the fact that it poked fun at American culture and presented actually quite a feasible reality future, I think, in some ways. And also it just has robots and guns in it, and I like robots and guns. So to make a film with a lot of the same ingredients, with also some of the same satire poking fun at society, it was a perfect mix. And early 80s science fiction was a big influence. People like Chris Foss, I don't know how familiar you are with him, but he was an artist whose work was prolific. I remember his work from when I was like 7 years old, 8 years old, where he would do these incredible spaceships and other worlds. And I always believed that his very colorful, very graphic versions of spaceships weren't really represented in science fiction that much. And so we tried to make the designs of District 9 have a little bit of a twist towards that. In the end, I mean, that influence was not that profound. It sort of becomes something that leads you on a way, on in a direction, but then you end up winding your way to a different point. And I didn't design the aliens, but I did work on their coloring and their patterns. This was actually sculpted by Jamie Bess Warwick. And the actual alien was designed by David Meng. So this is the baby version of one of the District 9 aliens. And I think, I mean, as a design, it has all the elements that you kind of expect of a classic alien. You know, an alien is supposed to be alien, right? It's principally supposed to be different than anything you've seen before. But because who could really guess what an actual alien species would like? It'd be very difficult. But Neil wanted, of course, for us to know that they're alien, but at the same time have something familiar. This is why they're bipedal. They have two arms, two eyes. And in the case of little CJ, Neil wanted very much for him to be both cute and disgusting at the same time. He wants you to learn to love him. You know, your initial reaction should be that these little guys are actually quite creepy, but as you progress through the film, you really learn to emote with them. And so there's a very interesting mix of characteristics, I think, in them. And it took a lot of, I mean, when I tell you about me having to redesign things halfway through, even after we've built them, the sculptor, David Meng, who designed the aliens, he designed probably, I think, yeah, three completely different versions of the alien. Now, that doesn't sound like very many, but there were actually hundreds of designs of the aliens, but three that were fully finished, and one that was built as a prosthetic suit. It was sent to South Africa for a test shoot, and the test shoot was relatively successful, but Neil came back and said, okay, great, but I want to do a different design. So he did a different design. And we built that as a prosthetic that an actor could wear on their face that we actually glued onto the face, and then a chest pieces that we, so we would shoot them from here up. And that was completely built, sent to, just about to be sent to South Africa. They were just going through the paint shop at Weta Workshop. And then suddenly Neil changed his mind again. And then we got this version. And even even right at the last minute, this is what I did with another artist from Vancouver, where we sort of reimagined some of the some of the articulation around the head. In fact, this is actually mainly the work of the artist from Vancouver. I really just did a bit of coloring on it and integrated it to make it appear a little bit more like how it would appear on screen. So I can't really take credit for that. But it shows you how much these designs go through an incredible evolution in many, many different iterations. I'll flick forward through some of this stuff. There's a lot of it. You can see some of the variations on the giant, on the spaceship, the mothership from the end of the film. In the end, Neil wanted it to be a classic UFO. He wanted it to be a big saucer. And the reason for that, because of course you can make an alien ship almost anything you want, right? You could, it could be ostensibly, you know, and very, not ostensibly, it could be very specifically alien. You could be you're trying to invent something that is fundamentally surprising to you that you've never seen before. But with this design, we were actually trying to make something that felt very industrial, like a huge refinery, and felt very pragmatic, like it has a function to it. But also, the fact that it's a saucer is very specific to the fact that Neil wanted to imply the fact that we've been invaded by aliens, or aliens have come to visit us straight away. You know, it's an icon. And because of the fact that it's iconic imagery, the audience hopefully understands straight away that that's a metaphor and that that's what that means. We don't need to go into explaining it. If you put something very abstract and complex, perhaps floating in the sky, then you have to do a little bit more narrative to explain what this is. And in a film like Neil's, where he wants to get cut to the chase, because the story is actually about Vickers. It's about Vickers's journey as a person. So it's not really actually about the aliens at all. That's actually all an aside. In that case, sometimes you just want to go for these sort of iconic things that sum that up in the audience's mind, and then you can move forward with the important stuff. So, and that was about 2 years, I think, that journey of working on District 9. And it's very intense. I know a lot of people at Weta felt very stressed out about it, and I was stressed out at various points, but I actually found it to be incredibly satisfying. And when I finally saw it, I saw it at San Diego Comic-Con the year it came out. I went into the movie theater very nervous, and I had no idea, because you never know, even working on a film, what it's really going to be like. And I think within about 5 minutes, I was sort of taken up on the journey, and I completely forgot any nerves. I wasn't even thinking about whether it would be a good film anymore. I had forgotten, and I was just watching it. So, and that's the, I suppose, the mark of a good film, or at least for me.
C'est clair que quand on voit un peu le type de travail qui peut être produit sur un film comme District 9, on a l'impression que, enfin, en tout cas, c'est mon impression, que l'artiste est tellement plongé dedans que finalement le reste n'existe pas. Alors, il s'avère que Greg développe aussi à côté ou a développé et continue à développer ses propres univers. Et là, il voulait montrer un petit peu des choses qui venaient d'un univers personnel, mais qui n'est pas encore celui du Dr. Gorbort. Et puis la question que j'ai envie de lui poser, peut-être pour introduire cette section, c'est de savoir comment ça se passe. Quand on est sur un film comme District 9, est-ce qu'on a le temps de faire autre chose? Dans quelle mesure est-ce que ce temps il est mis à profit pour son propre travail? Ou si justement toutes ces choses se mélangent et puis il n'y a pas vraiment de structure. On a un peu des fois ce mythe de l'artiste qui peut faire n'importe quoi, n'importe quand. Et peut-être de nous éclairer un peu là-dessus vu qu'on a la chance de l'avoir ici.
La question est sur le fait que quand vous travaillez sur District 9, par exemple, avez-vous le temps pour travailler sur votre personnel art ou pas? Yeah. And how are you managing the time between your personal work, Dr. Gorbort, District 9? I mean, how an artist could manage this time?
Yeah, as Mark alludes to, when even though I am spending my whole day, usually 10 hours a day, doing at Weta, and you're busy doing illustrations all day. For me personally, and I know this is the same for other artists at Weta, and I'm sure this is the same for artists around the world who have to do a professional job as well, as satisfying as working on these films are, they can be frustrating in places, and when you are sometimes churning out, you know, these hundreds of drawings over the course of time, and no one ever gets to see them, such as the case of Halo, or even in the case of a feature film like this, where you do many designs, and maybe the favorite design of yours didn't make it onto screen, it can be quite annoying. So it's a very delayed satisfaction. You know that in 2 years, hopefully, the film will come out, and then you will see the product of all your work and all your friends' work. But and then that sometimes, in the case of, say, Halo, the feature film, there was 2 years of work for no result at the end. So you have to kind of psychologically shield yourself from this. But for me, one way I get around it is that I just go home and I do more illustration. And I do it, and I put it out on the internet if I like it enough. And I do that partially because there are just ideas in your head that still want to come out, and I have extra hours at night. If I'm not playing a video game or sleeping, then I will... Then I'll do some more illustration, you know. And the thing for me is that all of these ideas might be the seed of something else, you know. They might, for instance, all with a lot of these ideas, they ended up becoming the world of Dr. Grodbort. The ray guns that you'll see upstairs, they started as simple paintings that I did for myself, and from that they suddenly became, I did a comic around it, and then another book, and then the exhibition, and we're developing very many facets of it. And so a simple idea like that, like I'm just going to draw some ray guns. I'll go home, you know, I think I did the ray guns over Christmas break. I just went home, I'll paint a bunch of them, I'll stick them on my wall, and that'll be that. And then from that simple idea, like, oh, okay, we'll make them. We'll make them as pieces of art, and then we'll sell them. And then from there, we'll just see. And it was a very organic process. And I'll just sweep through some of this stuff. And these are kind of the illustrations when, you know, you go home and just have an idea. I mean, drawing a robot is a very... organic and an easy thing for me to do. They just sort of naturally come out. Same with aliens. It's just, you know, it's almost idle. Your hand just starts going and your brain is just sort of in a, what's the right word? In a trance almost. I sit there I have a drink of beer and I paint some robots. And like I say, many of these ideas, maybe they'll go nowhere. Maybe they're just the moment in time and that's all they need to be. And I will never tell any more of the story. That is very much a moment in time. That's a bad day for that young boy, and his friend, and the whole town, and some of them. This illustration is for a friend who did an album called Angry Little Machine, and so this was just an afternoon doing an illustration for his album cover. And again, this is another idea where I thought, I love dinosaurs, but there's something to me symmetrical about dinosaurs and old World War I tanks, and especially the idea of them decaying while dinosaurs still exist. I don't know why. There's no real logic to it. There's no real story to it. It's just imagery that sort of works for me. And so if I can see some sort of future in it, like, then maybe there'll become a story out of it, but there doesn't have to be. You know, to me, if the moment is poignant or interesting or makes me smile or whatever, then that's enough. And this was one of those ideas again. Like, I somehow like the idea of samurai on the in World War I, you know, with that sort of clash of technology. And those are the sort of things that just pop into your mind. And how do I manage that time? I don't know. I think there's 24 hours in the day. I sleep a lot. I sleep 10 hours to 11 hours a day. I love to sleep. So I suppose I'm just busy. And I'm always... I don't like to too much, do a little bit, but I don't like to fine-tune things too much. I like energy in the illustration. I like to do it quickly and then move on. I know some of them probably look quite precise, but they're not. If you zoom in on them, they're very messy. And so I like to get the idea out. And maybe I would be honest and say a lot of my illustrations I really don't like. I'm very frustrated with them. They're not what I thought they were going to be when I started them. But it doesn't matter. I do it, I put it out, I move forward, and I do another one. Everything is a learning process. So I figure next time will be better, hopefully. And so that way, I suppose in that way, I'm quite productive. You know? Although I'm still not productive enough for my own liking. I don't do as much illustration as I want to. Too many things to do, not enough time.
On pourrait profiter de voir qu'effectivement, il y a quelque chose d'assez intéressant dans son travail personnel qu'on ne retrouve pas dans le travail de District 9 pour des raisons évidentes, qui est le rapport à l'ironie ou à l'humour. On voit pas mal de ces images qui font rire, qui rappellent en fait des choses et qui travaillent sur l'ironie, qu'on retrouve d'ailleurs dans l'imaginaire de Dr. Gorba. Alors je vais demander à Greg, en fait, quel est son rapport à ça et finalement, justement, quand on voit l'exposition sur le Dr. Gorbort, on voit beaucoup d'ironie, que ce soit dans les textes ou dans les images, et de voir comment il s'y rapporte par rapport à un travail plus, disons, cadré.
C'est une question sur l'ironie, parce que dans vos propres pictures et dans les pictures de Dr. Gorbort, vous voyez beaucoup d'ironie, beaucoup de fun, que vous n'avez pas, bien sûr, dans Weta. Et comment vous managez la différence entre l'ironie ou non dans votre personnel et le fait que ce n'est pas possible d'utiliser ça?
And that's a good question. I mean, for me in my personal work, it's just a matter of fact. I can't help do anything too seriously, you know. If I'm doing something for a client, then I need to... even then, I think if I was to go through all of the illustrations in District 9, you'll find there's lots of little ironic twists and little jokes. We always... I mean, there are jokes all through the artwork, specifically me and another artist, Christian Pierce. We always put silly little asides in our artwork. And I think... Maybe some clients get pissed off with it. They might be annoyed that we would do that. Yeah, even robots are going to want to know what the hell we were up to. And so I do hide that stuff in there. But in a film, of course, you don't really have that. I can't explain that image. It just is what it is. but for me, when I do my personal work, and I'll stop there. I can't help but put irony, put jokes in there. I just that's the way I view the world. I everywhere I look, I see, you see kind of hypocrisy or, you know, just people doing bizarre and hypocritical things or just idiosyncratic things. And so to me, the world is kind of a place like that to find humor in anyway. I think there's enough people making serious comments. And... I don't know. I've made music before. I've been in many bands over the years, and I love making music. And the band I'm in at the moment is very lively and funny and energetic and doesn't take itself too seriously as well. But, I mean, I went through a period as a teenager making very angsty, very emotional music. And I have that in me as well. So maybe one day I'll get a knock on the head and I'll suddenly become a very serious artist. But not now.
Voilà, maintenant, avant de passer à la période des questions, on a... nous présenter un peu l'univers de Dr. Gorbort, qui est un univers où il est évidemment complètement maître, puisqu'il est, comme l'indique le slide, à la fois créateur, artiste et écrivain. Donc c'est lui qui invente le scénario. Alors je vais poser la question justement de cette espèce d'amplification. On part de l'illustration pure et dure jusqu'à la construction d'un univers général qui va de personnages à, disons, matériaux narratifs, en passant par des créatures, par un univers, par un paysage, etc. Si ce n'est pas l'accomplissement finalement de son travail d'illustrateur.
But the question of Dr. Gorbort, you are not only an artist on this side, because you're also a writer and everything. Then how could you constitute a global universe? And is it an accomplishment for an artist to have the ability and the opportunity to do this and to show it to the other people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. When I, for me, creating Gorbort, as I said, was a process by layers. It starts very simple. And then it becomes complex over time. It didn't start out as a complex idea. I didn't start out with the goal that I wanted it to be a feature film or a video game or that I wanted to write a novel or whatever. I didn't imagine it as a fully formed world. I imagined it as a simple start, and then it just grows by layers. And for me, that's the way I like to create. I'm a very visually led person. I think about visuals, and I think about concepts. I think about worlds. I mean, like working at Weta, we design worlds. We design worlds for District 9, for Avatar, for Lord of the Rings, and so on. And so I it's a natural fit for me because that's the way I think anyway. And so I don't think as a writer with a narrative. I think as a writer who builds worlds. It's kind of a different process. And I know that not all artists want to do this. Some artists are very are quite happy to do just these moments, these things, and maybe there's no continuum or maybe they don't add up to a whole world. And I sometimes want to do that as well, as you see with my personal work. But with something like Dr. Gorbort, there's so much there I can see because it is based on our own history of science fiction. It's inspired by, you know, the science fiction from an earlier era. And so to me, there is just endless opportunity, you know. The first book I did was like was almost a message, two messages, one about advertising, because it was basically a catalogue of ray guns and rocket ships and all the things that you can use to go and, you know, subjugate the godless heathens of Mars and Venus. And at the end, there was a little comic, which is basically just a joke about how we destroy the natural world, or how, you know, how humans want to step on above everything else and separate themselves. And then the second book became a book about propaganda and about war and about expansionism, about colonialism, imperialism, about, you know, these kind of themes. And the third book that I've just finished, and I will finish writing when I get home, is more, it's a bit more personal. It's more, it's really more like pulp adventure, where I come back to Coxswain himself and write these stories. Because previously, the stories, if you can call them that, have really just been excuses to have a joke, or excuses to have to tell one little message, one very simple message. But now these new stories are actually more traditional. They're actually just race running along with Coxswain and learning more about him and wandering along with him for the ride, you know, for the fun of it. So to me, until the ideas kind of run out, and I want to add layers to this, and like I say, because it's based on our own history of fiction, there seems to be endless variety for that. I should have let the images. Yeah.
For the questions. Maybe you can present us your work now.
Yeah, sure. So you'll see a lot of this upstairs. And of course, I said the ray guns started with ray guns. Sorry, the Groardboard started with ray guns. And these are some of the custom ray guns we made. You know, actually, these ones were made as one-offs for specific customers. They're not necessarily within the Groardboard's world. This is, of course, inspired by a World War II American bomber. This one is inspired by imagery from the actual American Wild West, and it has a more of a Victorian kind of bent. So these are actually one-off, limited edition ray guns that we would do and sell to customers. The blunderbuss, the unnatural selector, is the main weapon of Lord Coxswain, and it's probably the most fun weapon I've designed for that world. You can see Spitfires and so on. the Russian space program. And so, yeah, and as I said, Groardboards is really just an excuse for me to explore all the things I find interesting. I play with, I'm very interested in World War One. I thought, I've always been fascinated with that, more fascinated than with World War Two. I know it's a strange thing to be fascinated with. It makes me very nerdy. But I've always been fascinated by the World War One as an almost science fiction war. I don't know if other people have talked about that concept, but to me, it's always seemed like it's science fiction is quite often about the clash of technology, you know. It's about normal culture suddenly being spun on its ear by something that fundamentally changes everything. And World War One seems like that to me. It was like you had formalized wars with, you know, with ranks of soldiers facing each other, and you had cavalry. And all of a sudden you had tanks, you had barbed wire, you had gas, you had zeppelins, you had aeroplanes, all these things. And that obviously just made a massive shitstorm. It just collapsed everything. And so that's fascinating to me. It's fascinating when humans introduce new technology that redefines everything. As a New Zealander coming from a distant place, I know that New Zealand sent many soldiers here, but maybe my distance from it makes me have a different perspective on it. I don't know if you have any more thought on that.
Peut-être que je vais aussi profiter à comme dernière question de lui. Moi, à chaque fois que j'ai vu son œuvre, j'ai à chaque fois pensé au film Starship Troopers. Je trouve quelque chose qui ressemble un petit peu à ça, mais en version un peu rétro-futuriste. Alors, voir un petit peu justement dans quelle mesure ces influences peuvent venir de l'esthétique aussi plus récente de la science-fiction et l'intérêt de décaler son univers dans le passé pour lui.
Why do you decide to put your work in the past, first of all, in a fictional past, and how could you be influenced by new science fiction or science fiction since the 18th until now?
Yeah, well, Paul Verhoeven's movie, The Starship Troopers, was a massive influence, and not a conscious influence. When I was creating conscious influence, when I was creating Groardboards, I wasn't thinking, well, I'm going to make something like Starship Troopers, but obviously in my head, you know, That film left a huge mark on me, and it has the same sorts of themes, you know. It treats them in a different way. It's pretty much like 90210 in space, or like sports teams in space. but it has the same idea of imperialism and, like, you know, just going out and bashing the others.
And the irony, too.
Yeah, and the irony. And that's Paul Verhoeven. I think as a filmmaker, he's done a lot to inspire me, left a real mark on me. And I think the same thing with, I grew up with 2000 AD and Judge Dredd, and I think there was the same sort of irony and satire in that in places. Why I choose to set it in the past, that was very simple. I just love science fiction from yesteryear. I always have. It comes from an early memory when I would lie on my nana's place, and she had a black and white television, and they had, you know, I would sit there on a Sunday afternoon and watch Flash Gordon, their black and white serials, and then King Kong and Tarzan and all these kind of adventure series that were written in the 20s and 30s, and they really just left a mark on me. They sort of stuck in my head. And so that era of adventure, when the world was wide open, and still our neighboring solar system was still wide open, and, you know, maybe there was all kinds of interesting things just nearby in our own little corner of space. That's very fascinating to me, and it's also naive, and it does simplify things, you know. And there is something about Grotewoods that is reveling in the naivety of an older era, you know. There is no real science in it. In a way, it's actually pure fantasy. Because, you know, if it was true science fiction, you know, then none of this would make any sense, you know. But that's kind of the, but that's the interesting thing about science fiction, right? Science fiction is actually often a debate about what's science fiction and what's not. I often think there is no such thing as science fiction. It's just fantasy with more silver paint, you know. Maybe that's true. But unless you want to, you know, I only think of a few, like 2001. And even there, you know, you've got like a black obelisk floating in space. In essence, that's a fantastical idea, I think. But, you know, that's another discussion. But the ingredients of science fiction are really appealing to me. Technology and what that enables. And I love the history of science fiction because it's actually a naive... It's when we look back at science fiction from yesteryear, we can see how we continuously interpret our future. We speculate on what we know at the time. And we usually get it wrong, you know, or we have a different perspective on it, and that will be the same as now. You know, when we make science fiction now that imagines what the future will be like, it will look very naive and quaint and funny to people in 50 years, and it will always be the case, because we'll always speculate only from the information we have now, and we'll always base it on our own culture, and that's a fascinating concept. That's what made me want to do Grotewoods, actually. These are actually just we actually made Dr. Grotewoods beer in New Zealand. Tastes like war. It was a porter. It was actually very delicious. We only made 50 litres of that and 50 litres of Venusian pale ale, and they were really good. But you'll have to come to New Zealand to drink them, I think, unfortunately. I very quickly show you, before we run out of time, some process of how an illustration can happen. And there are a couple different ways. This is an organic means of making an illustration where I don't know exactly how the composition is going to be. All I know is that it's going to be of a Venusian environment, of a jungle. And so it very much starts with a few scribbles, and then I start adding more chaos, and only after a little while does actually something start to form and it actually become an actual environment. And that's a very naturalistic and free way to make this kind of illustration. Same thing again here. This is, you can see it's just very raw brushstrokes. And it's only after a little bit of work that something actually starts to form. And I just let my eye lead me wherever I like and sort of start to form the world. And it becomes actually quite detailed. That's probably finished right there, but I decided to just keep on going and add more detail. But actually either is probably a good indication. And this is a sort of illustration that I would do for a game or a feature film of Dr. Grotewoods, where we wanted to build an environment as a set, or perhaps we would give this to a CG artist, and so they could build all the different plants. It's a good example of that type of work. And there's another one with very just loose forms. I wanted to make a much larger scale with these very weird and coral reef-like plants, as if they're from underwater almost. It's very lots of atmosphere. I love making atmosphere. And then this, although you can't see the procedure for it, this is a very different type of illustration where there was a meticulous drawing planned out, and I knew exactly where I wanted everything. And so the pencil drawing probably took an hour or something, and then the illustration probably took the whole day. The other illustrations, they might be like 45 minutes, half an hour to complete. So that's probably 45 minutes of work, and that's actually 10 hours of work. I don't know which, if it's better to spend 10 hours. In my mind, there's actually a correlation between how fast and how good an image is. The longer I take, the worse it gets, and sometimes up to a point. And this is a similar one. Yeah, and that's kind of the gist of the Grubbots world. I don't know if you want to ask anything more specific, or maybe if we should take some questions.
Voilà, si quelqu'un a des questions, on a encore quelques minutes pour les questions pendant que les images défilent.
Maybe the image is good.
I'll just let them roll again.
Put maybe this one because I could translate.
So you don't have any questions?
Yes. Hello. Congratulations on your work. Have you been influenced by video games?
Oh, definitely.
Which ones?
For Grubbots?
No, in general.
And I mean, my whole life is influenced by video games. Like, I started playing video games when I was about 5 or 6, I think. I mean, we didn't have a machine to start with because we didn't have too much money, but we had eventually we bought like an Atari 800 computer. And but before that, I would whenever my mum would go grocery shopping, she would go into the groceries. I would walk over to the electric store, and I would go and jump on their Atari consoles and just try and play. And so I've been fascinated with games my whole life. It's always interesting to me. It's kind of curious that I've ended up working on films because my main passion is actually video games. I don't go home like a lot of the other guys at Weta and watch films all night. I go home and I play video games all night. In fact, right now, it's very annoying. I'm here. I want to go home and play Uncharted and Skyrim. So I'm fascinated by them, and I always have been. And in terms of influencing me artistically, not so much. I don't really take too much visual influence. Like I say, you can see with Grubbots, it's inspired by many things. But like a lot of us, the older you get, and this is not necessarily a good thing, but you tend to be inspired by the stuff from your youth, or, you know, it's harder to be inspired by your contemporaries. What your contemporaries end up doing is setting a quality bar of how good you need to be. But I have no interest in replicating the kind of content that's being made. So if I see a lot of games that are based around similar themes, I don't want to make the same kind of game, or I don't want to make the same sort of world. I want to make something different. And so it's actually a little bit weird. As steampunk has become popular, and I never considered my world steampunk, but apparently it is, it actually made me less interested, because it's part of my psychology to want to try and do something that's different than everything else around. Like I say, video games inspire me for the level of artistry, but not necessarily the content.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Voilà, une autre question.
Pourriez-vous expliquer donc le lien que vous entretenez entre donc la ressemblance physique avec Dr Grubbots et puis aussi donc le nom de le personnage de Coxwell? Est-ce que ça a quelque chose de particulier par rapport à votre propre vécu, par rapport à, comment, pourquoi ce lien particulier?
Vous pouvez juste préciser le lien.
Le nom Dr Grubbots donc ressemble beaucoup au nom Greg Broadmore. Donc il y a un échange de lettres. Il y a une ressemblance physique avec le Lord Coxwain. Donc quel est ce lien particulier? Comment expliquez-vous ce lien?
La question est, what is the link if it exists between the word Dr Grubbots and yours,
yeah,
and the physique of Lord Coxwain and yours, and is it a personal investment in the universe,
yeah,
or not?
That's a good question. I think if there is there's a phonetic link between Grubbots and my name, my surname. I can tell you that it wasn't conscious. I'm aware of it now, of course. I am aware of it very quickly. But I'm a very stupid person, so I didn't notice it when I did it. But by the time I knew, I'd realized that I'd made something that's kind of like a phonetically similar to my name. I kind of thought. When it was too late, I'd already published a book and named it. It's like, oh, fuck. I thought I should name it. Now I should name it something different. Of course, I named it something incredibly hard for everyone to say. I don't know why I did that. People here have difficulty saying it. People in America have difficulty saying it. In China, they have everyone has difficulty saying it. So it was just one of those decisions. It's like if there was a marketing team behind me of very clever people, they would have said, no, don't do that. In fact, when I've been in L.A. and agents have said, like, that name, no, you can't, you know. They want to change the name, but it's like, it's too bad. It is what it is now. So, but yeah, it's one of those things. And a physical similarity to Coxway, I mean, like, I wish, I don't, you know, Jesus Christ. He's like 6'6" and like, you know. But I think, again, it's the same sort of thing. I think as an artist, maybe you mirror yourself to some degree or make, but while he's kind of a Superman in a way, he's a hulking, you know, human being, he's not really someone I would want to be. In a way, like, you know, it's like, would you like to be a sociopath for a week where you had no feelings towards anyone, you could just do anything you like? Maybe that would be fun for about a week, but I don't know. But I definitely don't want to be like him. But as far as a physical similarity, yeah, it's probably just natural. Like I say, it's the same thing. I'm just incredibly egotistical, but I didn't know it. I know it now.
Voilà, je crois qu'on est arrivé au bout. Je remercie Greg pour sa disponibilité et je vous remercie aussi pour votre participation, votre écoute et votre intérêt. Évidemment, j'espère que vous allez tous voir, si ce n'est pas déjà fait, l'exposition qui est au premier étage sur l'œuvre de Greg. Voilà, merci à tous.
Thank you. Cheers, guys.